Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the Psalms. We left off in the Psalm 21, and it's only 13 verses, but if possible, I would like to go through Psalms 21 and 22, because these are really messianic Psalms, and they deal with Jesus Christ in terms of, well, you know, everything in regards to his passion, his death, his resurrection. Is, you know, these Psalms are truly amazing in terms of their prophecies. And I just like to just preface what we're going to be reading tonight in this Psalm 20 and 21 in regards to, you know, what Jesus Christ had to say on the road to Emmaus. But this is what it says in Luke chapter 24. It says, "And behold, two of them," or two disciples, "were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about all these things which had taken place. And while they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them. But their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. And he said to them, 'What are these words that you are exchanging with one another as you are walking?' And they stood still, looking sad. One of them, named Cleophas, answered and said to him, 'Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?' And he said," or Jesus said to them, "'What things?' And they said to them, 'The things about Jesus the Nazarene, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word in the sight of God and all the peoples, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to the sentence of death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, it is the third day since these things happened. But also some women among us amazed us when they were at the tomb early in the morning, and they did not find his body. And they came saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just exactly as the women had said, but he," Jesus, "they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken, was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and enter into his glory?' Now listen to this. Then beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures." And now this is where they, you know, it was getting to be dark and they were going to their village, and Jesus pretended like he was going to go on further, but they really implored him to go with them. And that's when they reclined the table, that's when he broke the bread, and then that's when he recognized them. But this is what they said. He says, "Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. And they said to one another, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was speaking to us on the road, while he was explaining the scriptures to us?'" That's the thing. When we can really have our eyes open in terms of what the scriptures are saying to us, I mean, it really should stir us deep within our hearts to see, hey man, this is God speaking, and it really has tremendous relevance to each and every one of us. And, you know, it really speaks volumes in terms of our life and meaning and purpose and direction, both here and hereafter. And that's when these disciples got up and they ran back to Jerusalem, met up with the other disciples, and then it says this. He says that Jesus Christ appeared to them, and he said to them, "Hey, look at my hands, look at my feet, you know, see that it's me." And then he goes on to say this, after he asked for something to eat, and they took some broiled fish and he ate it. It says, "Now he said to them, 'These are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all these things which are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled.'" So what we're reading here in the Psalms, it's Jesus Christ who certified their divine inspiration, and he certified their credentials as being God's word to us. And what we're going to be reading as far as Jesus Christ in tonight, all these things were predicted. And these predictions were made something like 900 years before Jesus Christ was even born. But, you know, having prefaced this chapter 21 and 22, pick up with this verse 1 of chapter 21. In the Psalms, it says, "O Lord, in your strength the king will be glad, and in your salvation how greatly he will rejoice. You have given him his heart's desire. You have not withheld the request of his lips. For you meet him with the blessings of good things, and you set a crown of fine gold on his head. He asked life of you, and you gave it to him, length of days forever and ever. His glory is great through your salvation. Splendor and majesty you placed upon him. For you have made him most blessed forever. You make him joyful with gladness in your presence. For the king trusts in the Lord, and through the loving kindness of the Most High, he will not be shaken. Your hand will find out all your enemies. Your right hand will find out those who hate you. You will make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in his wrath, and fire will devour them. Their offspring you will destroy from the earth, and their descendants from among the sons of men. Though they intended evil against you and devised a plot, they will not succeed, for you will make them turn their back. You will aim with your bowstrings at their faces. Be exalted, O Lord, in your strength. We will sing and praise your power. Like I said, if we just read this and we don't understand the context of it, a lot of people might read this and say, well, this was a psalm written by David, so he must be talking about himself. But this goes way beyond David. Mm-hmm. You can always make an application in regards to him, but this goes way beyond him. It's a messianic psalm. It's about Jesus Christ himself. Let's just go back to that verse 1. It says, O Lord, in your strength the king will be glad. Now, like I said, you can apply it to David. It's really applying to Jesus Christ. The king will be glad, and in your salvation how greatly he will rejoice. You have given him his heart's desire, and you have not withheld the request of his lips. Now, that's kind of interesting, because what do you think was Christ's heart's desire?
For all men to accept him.
Be one as he and his Father are one.
Yeah, you know what? If you go back to Psalm 1, it's actually talking about here in the Psalm 21 as well. It's talking about Jesus Christ, and it's also talking about his enemies and how he's going to put them down. But in Psalm 2, it says this. It says, why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Now, who's the Lord and who's his anointed?
Father and the Son.
Yes. And he says, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger, and he will terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell the decree of the Lord. And he said to me, and the God the Father said to the Son, you are my Son, today I have begotten you. Now listen to this. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. Now, we're talking about right here what he's talking about, his heart's desire. That verse 2 in Psalm 21, you have given him his heart's desire, and you have not withheld the request of his lips. Well, if you look over here in Psalm 2, it says, ask of me, and I will surely give you the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possessions. That was Jesus Christ's heart's desire. His desire to see all men saved, mm-hmm. All right? But the ones that were going to reject him, of course, they are going to end up on the wrong side of eternity. But his desire was to save men and to dwell with men and be with men, because that's what it says in Psalm 2. It says, ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now, when's he going to do that?
His second coming.
He comes back with a great power, great glory. Every eye is going to see him. With a two-edged sword comes out of his mouth. He's going to slay the wicked, and then he's going to set up his kingdom. And then his heart's desire is going to be fulfilled in terms of seeing just the great multitude that is going to be saved because of his sacrifice that he made to redeem men. And then it just goes on to say in Psalm 2, it says, now therefore, O kings, show discernment, take warning, O judges of the earth, worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling, do homage to the Son that he not become angry, and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are those who take refuge in him. And I'm telling you, you look at what the Psalms are saying, it's all about Jesus Christ, every bit of it. You just got to be able to discern, okay, now how does this apply to him? And then you see in that verse 3 of Psalm 21, it says, for you meet him with the blessings of good tidings. You set a crown of fine gold on his head. He asked life of you, and you gave it to him, length of days forever and ever. Now, look at this. He asked life of you, and you gave it to him. let's just read a little bit further, because it's really talking about his resurrection. Look at that verse 4. He asked life of you, and you gave it to him, length of days forever and ever. It goes way beyond just David in this life here. He says, his glory is great through your salvation, splendor and majesty you placed upon him. For you make him most blessed forever. You make him joyful with gladness in your presence, for the king trusts in the Lord, and through the loving kindness of the Most High, he will not be shaken. Your hand will find out all your enemies, and your right hand will find out those who hate you. You will make them as a fiery oven in the time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them in his wrath, and fire will devour them. Now, here's the thing. It's talking about here, in that verse 4, he asked life of you. You gave it to him, length of days, forever and ever. It's talking about, you know, his resurrection. But here's the thing. I almost think you got a couple of Psalm 21 and Psalm 22 with Isaiah 53. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most amazing prophecies that's ever written in the Bible. It's probably written about 740 years before Jesus Christ was born by Isaiah. It's only like 12 verses, but there's no less than 44 different details mm-hmm. that are given in regards to Jesus Christ, in regards to his saving men, because it says, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Now, it starts off this psalm with a question. It says, who has believed our message? Now, people don't have a hard time believing in quote-unquote God, right?
Yeah.
They don't have most people will tell you they believe in God, that they are spiritual. You'd be hard-pressed to find these hardcore atheists, all right, who are just hell-bent on believing that they just came out of a mud hole. Most people will claim that they're spiritual. Most people will profess to believe in God. And it's really not God that's the offense. And it's not Jesus Christ that's the offense. What's the offense?
The message of repentance.
The message. The message. See, people don't want to believe the message. They don't have any problem in believing in Jesus Christ. They don't have any problem in believing in God. It's just that they have a real problem with the message, because the message is one of repentance. And the message can be summed up as, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that those who believe in him should not perish, which means what?
Die eternally.
Go to hell, but have everlasting life. But when it says to believe in him, it means to obey him.
Mm-hmm.
To obey him. You can't separate the two. See, so that's the message that people find most offensive. And it says here in that verse 2 of Psalm 50, Isaiah 53, for he grew up before him, or he, Jesus Christ, grew up before his father like a tender shoot, like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him, which means what?
Look like any of us is.
Yeah, that's one of the things why people just found it so offensive, is that Jesus Christ was so ordinary looking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't have a halo around him. He didn't have an aura around him. He didn't have lightning coming from him. When people were thinking about the Messiah, they always thought about somebody who's coming, you know, who's going to be in great power, great glory, and a conquering hero, and do away with Rome, and do away with all their enemies. Well, that's one of the reasons why they took such an offense at Jesus Christ. And in verse 3 of Isaiah 53, it says, he was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised and we did not esteem him. And that fits Jesus Christ to a T. Mm-hmm. Everything that happened to him, and even his apostles deserted him. And it goes on to say in Isaiah 53, surely our griefs he himself bore and our sorrows he carried, yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken and smitten of God and afflicted. Isn't that what they felt like at the cross? We read that in Matthew, read that in John. Mm-hmm. People were just basically shaking their heads, feeling like, well, he's just a sinner. He's dying for his own sins. And then in Isaiah 53:5, he says, he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening of our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before his shears, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due? Now let me ask you something. When it says in this Isaiah 53 verse 8, it says, by oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living? What does it mean to be cut off from the land of the living?
Killed.
He was killed. You know, that he was killed for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due. His grave was assigned with the wicked men. What's that? What was that?
The
thief on his right and the thief on his left. His grave was assigned with wicked men. Yet he was with a rich man in his death. When was that?
Joseph
of Arimathea. He was a rich man, and him and Nicodemus got Jesus' body, permission from Pilate to take Jesus' body down, and they buried him in Joseph's tomb. He was assigned with the wicked men, yet he was with the rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. In other words, you know, he wasn't dying for his own sins. He was totally innocent. And then it says in verse 10 of Isaiah 53, but the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he would see his offspring, and he would prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, as he will bear their iniquity. Therefore, I will allot him with a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Now, here's the thing. I wanted to read that far down, and going back to what it says right here in this verse 10 of Isaiah 53. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he would see his offspring. Now, if he's going to see his offspring, and it says here he pours out himself to death, then it's talking about his resurrection. You can't get around it. He dies, but then he's going to live again. You see what I'm saying? It talks about his resurrection, because in Isaiah 53 it says this, if he would render himself as a guilt offering, he would see his offspring, and he would prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. In other words, prolong his days, he will live eternally. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. Now that's the thing. What's he going to be satisfied for?
He was satisfied that he was able to save.
That men would be saved, right? Yeah. And by his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I, God the Father, will allot him, Jesus Christ, a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong. Now, what's the booty? There's going to be crowns that are meted out. Right, we are told that in scriptures, and there's going to be rewards that are meted out for people who live for God and serve God and obey God and this type of thing. Well, when Jesus Christ returns, what's going to be on his head?
Crowns.
Many diadems, which means many crowns, many rewards. So when it comes to rewards, Jesus Christ is going to share the booty with the strong. In other words, you know, everyone who's basically awarded by God or rewarded by God for, you know, saving souls and for serving him. All right, it says here, therefore I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death. You can't get around that, right?
Yeah.
But he's going to prolong his days, right? And he was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sins of many and interceded for the transgressors. Now, you know, you just can't get away from that, right? Now, you could almost sum up the entire Bible, if you were just to distill it down into one verse, it would be 25 words. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Those 25 words are probably the most profound words that have ever been written, because, like I said, you could distill the entire Bible down to that. Just think about that for a minute. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him, whoever obeys him, should not perish, means should not go to hell, but have everlasting life. And we have to understand something, okay, because I think that, this whole concept of cheap grace has really taken hold in the church today. This whole idea of cheap grace, and we don't realize, I think a lot of people have just lost sight of what is involved when it comes to our salvation. It cost God his Son, and what's it going
to
cost us? It's going
to
cost us our lives. And I think that, man, people are just missing this today, of what the lengths that God went through to save man. To save man from what?
Eternal death.
To hell. You know, there's a fable about, you know, this king who really, this king was just, he couldn't get enough wisdom. He couldn't read enough books dealing with proverbs or adages or wise sayings or wise counsel or wise understanding. He was always devouring everything that could give him insight and give him wisdom. And so one day he decided, you know what? I want to learn everything that's out there as far as every wise saying that's ever been written. And so he got together his administration, and he had a number of his servants go throughout all the known world to be able to gather together all the information that's out there, every wise saying that was ever spoken by anyone. It didn't matter what language, what nationality, he wanted to have it all. Anyway, he sent out all of his servants, thousands of them, throughout north, south, east, and west, collect all the wise sayings of his day. And anyway, long story short, it took them years. And they finally come back, and they had volumes and volumes of books. And he just devoured these books. He said, "This is absolutely fantastic." He says, "But it's way, way too much. There's way too much information here. I want you to distill it down, get it down, because it's just too much." And so they worked on it for years, and they got it down to one book, and he read the book, and it was just great. He just was really impressed by this book. He said, "But you know, it's still too long. You got to distill it down." So they distilled it down to one chapter, and he was really beside himself with it, you know, saying, "This is fantastic." But he said, "You know what? You got to distill it down. Distill it down." So they got it down to one paragraph. And then, you know, he just said, "This is absolutely mind-boggling what is written here." And they said, "But you know what? It's still too long." So then he finally got it down to one sentence. "This is all the wisdom of the ages. It can be summed up in, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You may think you're having a free lunch, but there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as free salvation. What did it cost? What did it cost? You may think, well, you know, I got a free steak dinner. Well, wait a minute. Somebody else paid for that, and that cow you're munching on paid a hefty price for your free dinner. There's no such thing as a free lunch." You know what I mean? And people have to understand what Christ has went through to save men, and what God has gone through to save men. And that's why it says in Hebrews, "How shall we escape if we neglect," not reject, just neglect, "so great a salvation?" Just take it for granted, just ho-hum, just yawn, just go to church twice a year or whatever, be kind to God, whatever, you know. It's like, hey man, when we're reading what's really involved here in terms of our salvation, people got to understand what it cost God to save us. And what it's going to cost us, because it's going to cost us our lives. We're going to have to die to ourselves, pick up the cross daily, and follow Him. Yeah.
You know, when you say that about the hamburger or the steak or whatever, it reminds me, the farther away you are from the sacrifice that's been made, the easier it is to forget and not
take it for granted. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But now, here's the thing. It talks about Christ's desire in terms of save men, but then we never can get away from the other side of the coin. And it picks up in that verse 8, "Your hand will find out your enemies, and your right hand will find out those who hate you. You will make them as a fiery oven in a time of your anger. The Lord will swallow them up in His wrath. The fire will devour them." Now, what's that talking about?
Hell.
It's talking about hell. You can't get around it. That's what it's talking about. And you know what? Paul says this very, very clearly, is even in hell, people are going to bend their knee, because, you know, he says this in Philippians. He says, "Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. For this reason also God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee will bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Now, he's saying it very clearly here. There's coming a day where every tongue will confess and every knee will bow in heaven, on earth. And when he says under the earth, what does that mean?
In hell.
In hell. You see, There's not one atheist in hell, and there's not one person in hell who says, well, I don't believe in Jesus Christ. You know, I believe in Buddha. I believe in Muhammad. I believe in Krishna. I believe in this, that, and the other. No, no. Even in hell, people are going to bend their knee and confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And I'm willing to bet that every demon in hell is going to be forced to do the exact same thing. Because if we reject so great a salvation, then what's left? What's left? You understand what God has gone through to save man. And that's what these psalms really deal with a great deal. Mm-hmm. And but people, all they seem to just focus in on is, okay, well, you know, God is love, God is tolerant, God is accepting, and, you know, just sing kumbaya, hold hands, and everybody try to be good, and everybody try to get along, go along, and, you know, then you have all the social justice issues, and wait a minute. Our salvation is not tied up in those things. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I give like $20 for the poor. So what? That doesn't mean anything, right? Mm-hmm. We've got to understand what our salvation rests upon and what it's all involved and what it's going to cost us, right? Mm-hmm. Because he says in this verse 10 of Psalm 21, he says, their offspring you will destroy from the earth and their descendants from among the sons of men. Meaning what? You know, the wicked, they're going to be destroyed. And their names are going to be blotted out. Granted, you can have some, look at like Madeleine Marie O'Hare, this godless atheistic woman who did so much to bring, throw God out of our schools and just blaspheme his name. She ended up with a son who ended up giving his life to Christ. He's a minister. There's always the exception there, but I tell you what, people who are just hell-bent on, you know, defying God, their name is going to be blotted out forever. Forever. And it says in verse 11, it says, though they intended the evil against you and devised a plot, they will not succeed. Now, look at all the people that intended the evil against Christ. Where's Caiaphas tonight? Where's Ananias tonight? Where are the scribes, the Sadducees, the Pharisees? I mean, unless they repented, you know, they're not where they should be. But then just go all the way down through the ages, you know. Everybody who has rejected Christ or who has refused to obey him is going to end up on the wrong side of eternity. And believe me, it's not soul sleep. It's not soul sleep, man. It's not soul sleep. You're not going to be able to just defy God. And that last verse of chapter 21 of Psalms, it says, be exalted, O Lord, in your strength, and we will sing and praise your power. And keep something in mind. We were dealing with God's wrath up here of those who reject what he has done on that cross. But God is going to be glorified even in judgment. Even in judgment, God is going to be glorified in this great white throne judgment where all the damned stand before God. There's not one saved soul in this great white throne judgment. And there's myriads upon myriads. There's billions of people standing stark naked before this great white throne. It's all on fire. And it's just, you know, fire is just flowing from it. And there's countless angels and ministering unto God. But when he's on that throne, and this is that great white throne judgment where he judges all the damned. Believe me, I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to see anyone go to hell. I don't care how bad they've been. That's why I work so hard to try to keep people out of it. But I'm telling you what, I look forward to that day for one reason only. I want Christ to be vindicated. I want his people to be vindicated. I want his word to be vindicated. I want the truth to come out. Evolution. Oh, look at that. Look at that lie that's spewed out of the bowels of hell. And everybody's buying into it, even people in the church. I want that lie to be exposed for what it is. But God's going to be glorified when it says here in that verse 13, be exalted, O Lord, in your strength. We will sing and praise your power. Now, I always go back to that great white throne judgment. It's like Solomon. He was a type of Christ. When he sat on that throne to judge people, remember the two prostitutes? One of them, you know, they gave birth to baby boys at about the same time. One of them in the middle of the night accidentally rolled over on her baby and accidentally suffocated her baby, and she woke up in the middle of the night, realized she had a dead baby. So I don't want a dead baby. So she takes her baby boy, goes into her roommate's room, takes the live child and puts the dead child in the bed. And when the mother woke up in the morning, she saw this dead baby and says, well, this isn't my baby. And then there was that contention, there was that arguing, there was that bickering back and forth. That's my baby. No, that's my baby. And it finally got to Solomon. And they were saying back and forth, this is mine. And it was Josephus is the one, if you read his account, He gives a little bit more detail to this because Solomon says, okay, I'll tell you what, you get a sword, cut that kid in half. You give half to her and half to her. And Solomon said, and Josephus says that they actually brought both babies in, the dead baby and the live baby. And Solomon said, cut them both in half. You get half of the dead one, you get half of the live one. You know what I'm saying? And then it says, Josephus says that everybody in that entourage or that court or that administration, they started whispering under their mouth saying, oh, Solomon's a fool. Solomon's an idiot. What kind of idiotic decision is this? This guy's just a child. He's got no business running this nation. And then, you know, when he said, cut that kid in half, and then the real mother says, oh, don't do that, don't do that, give it to her. Then the other woman says, oh, he'll neither be mine nor hers. Cut him in half. And Solomon said, well, you're not the mother for crying out loud. Give that kid over there to the mother. Then everybody could see the wisdom of this man. Everybody was blown away by his decision. And I'm telling you what, when that great white throne judgment, people are going to see the wisdom of God, the righteousness of God, the holiness of God, the justice of God. They're going to see it. And they're going to know that even if people go to hell, God is going to be glorified. So when you read that last verse there, be exalted, O Lord, in your strength. We will sing and praise your power. That's what it's talking about. You know what I'd like to do? What I'd like to do is I'd like to read this Psalm 22. I know it's kind of long, but I want to read the whole thing. I want to read the whole thing because it deals with Jesus Christ's suffering. And then I'll just comment on it rather than going down and breaking down each verse because we don't have the time and it's too lengthy. But I didn't want to separate these two psalms because it's talking about Jesus Christ and basically a prophecy about his death on that cross. Because in Psalm 22, verse 1, it says this, my God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Yet you are holy, O you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted it, and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were delivered. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. But I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate their lips. They wag their head, saying, commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him because he delights in him. Yet you are he who brought me forth from the womb, and you made me trust when upon my mother's breast. Upon you I was cast from birth, and you have been my God from my mother's womb. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They opened wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. And you have laid me in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me, and a band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all of my bones. They look and they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen. You answer me. I will tell of your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All your descendants of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him. All your descendants of Israel, for he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him for help, he heard. From you comes my praise in the great assembly. I shall pay my vows before those who fear him. The afflicted will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your heart live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship, and all those who go down to the dust will bow before him, even he who cannot keep his soul alive. Posterity will serve him. It will be told of the Lord to the coming of a generation. They will come, and they will declare his righteousness to a people who will be born that he has performed it. Now, like I said, it's 31 verses. It's quite lengthy, but it really covers a lot of ground in regards to Jesus Christ and the prophecies in regards to his death on that cross. And I think I could kind of summarize it, you know, maybe distill it down, because this is dealing with a number of things that were all obviously foretold centuries before Jesus Christ died. But there was actually seven things that were spoken to Christ or spoken to the cross. You remember what they were?
To the cross.
Seven things.
If you are the Christ, save yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. What's that?
It is finished.
Well, no, that's spoken from the cross.
Oh.
Things that are spoken to the cross.
And if you are, I forget the one.
But yeah.
Surely this man was the Son of God.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, let me just distill it down, okay? This is what it says in Matthew chapter 27, verses 39 through 40. It says, the passersby hurled abuse at him. They wagged their heads and cried, you would pull the temple down, would you, and build it up in 3 days? Come down from the cross and save yourself if you are indeed the Son of God. Now, who were these kind of people?
God.
It says the passersby. The passersby. Now, who are the passersby today? Notice what they said. The passersby hurled abuse at him and wagged their heads and cried, you would pull the temple down, would you, and build it up in 3 days? Come down from the cross and save yourself, and we will indeed, if you are indeed the Son of God. See, the passersby are the ones who can quote just enough of what Jesus Christ said to distort it. These are the passersby. And what do they say? Come down from the cross and save yourself if you are indeed the Son of God. Now, this is the thing. We are told in Corinthians that the cross is an offense. Why is the cross such an offense?
You can't save ourselves. Man wants to think they can save themselves.
That cross is saying what?
We're sinners.
There's no good people going to heaven. You're all going to hell, and you better kneel at that cross to be absorbed by its mercy, because right behind it is a huge chasm, you know, of eternal hell. Now, that's why the cross is a defense. It is a defense, because they're saying, you're not good. We're not good. But ask a person, ask anybody, if you die tonight, where do you think you go? Well, if there's a heaven, I guess I'll go there. Why? I'm basically good. Well, no. You know, that's why that crosses offense, yeah.
I think it's an offense for another reason also, and that is that people understand that you have to be able to say, I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And they know crucifixion is a very painful thing. You got to die yourself.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think that's what, I knew I was a sinner all my life. But I didn't want to die. I didn't want to give up my life. And that's why it was an offense to me.
Yeah, that's it. Because it says in Corinthians, it says this, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, it says this, for the word of the cross is a foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Now, who are perishing? One's going to hell. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since the wisdom of God, the world, through its wisdom, did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed the Jews asked for signs, and Greeks searched for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are being called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And then it goes on to say, consider your calling, man. There's not a whole lot of people who are in high echelons or the cultural elite who are belonging to your ranks, right? That's the thing. It's like the cross is an offense. But it's the wisdom of God and the power of God. Also, another thing that was spoken to the cross was from the thief, who was at first mocking Christ, but he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. That's the only thing that was spoken to the cross that wasn't offensive. That was recorded in Luke 23. And also the third one says, are you not this Messiah? Save yourself and us. Now that's what these two thieves were saying. But then again, these guys are on the cross next to Christ, right and left. And these guys heard all about Jesus. You couldn't live in Palestine at that particular time without hearing about Jesus. You know, he was a legend in his own time. So these guys are hanging there and say, hey man, if you're really Messiah, come off of there and get us off too. Again, Matt, we'll believe in you if we get off the cross. Because the cross is an offense, right? And that was in Luke 23. Also the fourth thing, and he saved others, but he cannot save himself. King of Israel, indeed, let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusted in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him. For he said, quote, I am the Son of God, unquote. And that was in Matthew 27. Now these are the religious leaders. Mm-hmm. Look at this. Mm-hmm. Look at, he saved others, true, but he can't save himself. False. King of Israel, indeed, true. Let him come down from the cross, and we will believe in him. Again, the religious leaders got to come off that cross. He trusted in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him, for he said, I am the Son of God. Now, these are religious leaders, right? But, man, they don't want to believe him on that cross, because like Kevin says, that means, hey, man, we got to be up there too, right? That's what Paul says, I'm crucified with Christ. But that was the intelligentsia. That was the religious leaders. They knew just enough about what Jesus Christ said to distort it. Also, a fifth thing that was spoken. All right. Now, this was spoken when Jesus Christ said, Eli, Eli, Lemai Sabachthani. All right. This is what Jesus Christ said. Now, this is what we said in response, because that what that meant was, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Now, what did we just read here in Psalm 22? First thing. Right? Now, that's what he spoke. And that was in Psalm 22:1, and that's what Jesus Christ said. All right, why hast thou forsaken me? But then, what happened was that people thought he was calling for Elijah, mm-hmm. right? And they said, "Well, let's see if Elijah comes and takes him off the cross." And that's when they dipped some sour wine and gave it to him. But again, people are looking for something other than a Messiah on the cross. They're looking for Elijah. Well, let's see if Elijah comes, because the cross is an offense. Also, you know, the soldiers mocked him and coming up to him, offering him sour wine and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. Again, now these are the pagans. These are Romans. Come off the cross. Everybody finds that cross an offense, right? Mm-hmm. And there was no doubt their ridicule was probably inspired, because they saw the inscription up there, Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, right? Mm-hmm. And to the Roman soldier, well, some king you are, hanging up there, because they equate kingship with power and authority and might and that type of thing, right? So they're mocking him, right? And also, I think Rachel mentioned, it was finally when Jesus Christ did die, instead of breaking his legs, this Roman centurion thrust through his spear into Jesus Christ's side. But then he said, what? Yeah, it said truly this was the Son of God. Now, legend has it, or tradition has it, or church history says that this Roman soldier, his name was Longinus, and he ended up becoming a Christian and ended up becoming a bishop in the early church and ended up being martyred. Now, that's church tradition. You're not going to read that in the Bible, but those are the things that were spoken to the cross. Now, what were the things spoken from the cross?
My God, why
are you yeah. We were just reading there.
Thirst.
Yeah. Good, good. That, you know, that was the first thing he said.
Behold your mother, and mother behold your
good.
Son.
You guys are getting this one. It said that Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That was in Luke 23:24.
Today you will be with me
in paradise.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And, you know, When Jesus Christ saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What was the first murder?
Cain and Abel.
Abel. What did God say about Abel's blood?
The cross.
He says, you know, God said to Cain, hey, where's your brother Abel? He says, well, I don't know. My brother's keeper. You know, isn't that insolent? Mm-hmm. And God said to him, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. The suggestion to me is he buried him, and the blood is crying out from the ground. Now, Jesus' blood is crying out for what? Abel's blood was crying out for vengeance. Abel's blood was crying out for retribution. Jesus' blood is crying out for what? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, right? And also, the thief on Jesus Christ, right. And when I say right, you won't read the right in the Bible, but church tradition said it was a thief on the right. Okay, that's just tradition. But Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now, that was spoken by the thief. Now, at first, he was mocking Jesus, saying, come off the cross, and then he has an epiphany. Then he realizes, man, I'm going to die. And this Jesus Christ, you know, he doesn't belong there. And so he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus Christ said, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. That was Luke 23. Now, he didn't say today thou will be with me in heaven, did he? Because even in the Apostles' Creed, they said Jesus Christ descended into hell. Well, he descended in a place called the Hades or the netherworld, which was divided into two parts, torments or hell, and the other place was called Abraham's bosom or paradise. We read that in Luke 16, right? So when Jesus died, his soul went to paradise, but it wasn't until after he ascended 40 days later that then he took all these souls, all Old Testament patriarchs who believed in God, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel, all these people, including the thief on the cross, he brought them to heaven. But what's always been a mystifying to me is, what about the thief on the left? Here you got two guys who are going through the exact same pain, the exact same suffering, they're experiencing the exact same torment, and they're just in total anguish. One, his suffering leads him to God, leads him to repentance, leads him to belief, right?
Yeah.
And the mystery to me is, well, what about the other guy? You would think, man, you think, man, you know, I better get right with God. But apparently he dies blaspheming, and he's still blaspheming tonight. And it always is baffling to me. People can be suffering some of the most difficult things. I don't care whether they're dying of cancer or some painful disease, or they got all kinds of problems, and you wonder, man, what's it going to take before you come to God? And it's just dying. I mean, I know people like this. Look, I mean, it's just amazing to me. And also, like Lori said, when Jesus Christ saw him hanging out the cross, he looked at John, the apostle, and he saw his mother, says, son, behold thy mother, mother, behold thy son. I think it really showed that, you know, Jesus Christ, in the midst of all of his pain, was thinking of other people, and he was concerned about his mother, and, you know, because him being the oldest son, I mean, you know, it's kind of like his responsibility, but he gave that to John, right? And also, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's what we read tonight, Psalm 22:1, right? You'd have to really, Jesus Christ has tasted this bitter emptiness, loneliness on behalf of men who reject God. That's why God just withdrew any sense of his presence. And he experienced that to the last dregs. That's why he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Also, he said, I thirst. That was one of the last things he said. And that was a fulfillment. We're going to be reading in the next psalm about, you know, a continuation about this. I can't do it all tonight, but when we get into the next chapter, I'm going to be dealing with that too. Psalm 22. As far as everything was predicted, as far as Jesus Christ's death and his burial, his resurrection. Also, Jesus Christ said, it is finished. Now, here's the thing. When he says it's finished, you go all the way back to the book of Numbers, and I think it's chapter 19. It may be 14, but you go back to the book of Numbers. There's a guy who's gathering firewood on the Sabbath day. They bring in Moses. Moses doesn't know what to do with this guy, so he puts him in a holding pen, goes to God, says, what do you want me to do with this guy? He's gathering firewood on a Sabbath day. And God says, stone him to death. Okay? Now, to the natural mind, that's a total miscarriage of justice. But Jesus Christ did away with the death penalty when?
When he stopped the adulterous woman from being stoned.
Yes, yes. He did away with the death penalty for all of these different offenses that required the death penalty. I don't care whether it was murder, whether it was adultery, whether it was homosexuality or bestiality or kidnapping or, you know, being a false prophet or just going down the line, sorcery, being a medium, being a witch, you know, all these things. Well, Jesus Christ did away with the death penalty with all these things, with the exception, in my opinion, of murder. But that's a whole new thing in itself. But all I'm saying is this. The death penalty pointed to the second death.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And that's what it really pointed to. So when Jesus Christ said it is finished, and you got to understand what that was pointing to in regards to this guy gathering firewood on the Sabbath. We need to rest in the finished work of Christ. If we just feel like, well, I don't need Jesus Christ to get to heaven. I can get to heaven by, quote unquote, being good. Guess what? You're breaking the Sabbath, and therefore you're going to experience eternal death. Mm-hmm. So when Jesus Christ says it is finished, we can't add to his work. Because it isn't Jesus Christ plus. That's what the Jews thought. Well, okay, you accept Jesus Christ, but now you've got to be circumcised. Now you've got to keep all the dietary laws and the ceremonial laws and the cleansing laws. And otherwise, you're not saved. No, it's not Jesus Christ plus. Mm-hmm. All right, rest in his finished work. And also, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Right, that was basically the last thing he said. And I often wonder, what's going to be my last words? What's going to be your last words? I hope it's something like that, you know. I'm afraid if I'm driving down the road and there's a semi coming at me, right at me, I'm going to go, oh, S-H-I-T, boom, that's going to be the last. I hope that's not my last word. But you never know, you know. Yeah. But then, how did Jesus Christ give up his spirit? Good. Who said that? With a loud cry. Now, we understand something here. I'm sure most of us have heard of the term death rattle. What is that? What does that mean?
The last gasp.
You can tell when a person's dying because it's just kind of this gurgling. It comes from their throat. They're dying of exhaustion. And there's just kind of a rattle that goes in their throat. And you can tell, well, he's going to die in a minute. And then they give up their spirit. Well, Jesus Christ, he didn't die of exhaustion. He gave up his spirit with a loud cry. In other words, death didn't claim him. He went out to meet death when he said, it is finished. So I'm telling you what, I'm basically out of time. Otherwise, I would deal with a lot of these other aspects in regards to this prophecy, but it can continue on in chapter 22.
We'll 23.
I'm sorry, 23. It will continue on with this all of these different prophecies, because there's so many that Jesus Christ fulfilled in just one day in regards to his coming. But one other thing, I just talked about the seven things that were spoken to the cross, seven things that were spoken from the cross, and there was also seven wounds. What were they?
Seven what?
Wounds.
The two nails
and
the... hands?
Feet?
Does that count as four?
Yeah.
Oh. The
side.
The thorns on the head.
Yeah.
And then the lashes?
Yes. And just keep this in mind, okay? That the nails in his hands, what did that make atonement for?
Sins that we do with our hands?
Yeah, everything that we do to offend God. Go in and rip somebody off and see if that's not an offense that he's making atonement for, right? What about our feet?
When we wander astray.
Yeah, all of us like sheep have gone astray, right? Every path that we walk down, and God says, hey, go down this path. No, we're going here. Going, okay, his feet, right? And then also the scourging for all the sins of the flesh, the sexual sins especially, and then also the crown of thorns to make atonement for what?
Our thoughts.
All our evil thoughts. I mean, all the impure, uncharitable, unkind thoughts, just go on and on and on, right? Making atonement for that. Also the wound in the side.
Heart.
What comes out of our heart? According to Jesus Christ.
Wickedness.
And you read it in Mark chapter 7, I believe, from the abundance of the heart, or from the heart come forth fornication and adulteries and thefts and murders and lying and cheating and stealing and conniving, everything, all these things, including foolishness, come out of the human heart, making atonement for that. But one other thing, too, just out of respect for Christ, a lot of times if you see a cross with Christ on it, he's always got a loin covering on him. But I believe that he died buck naked, totally stripped naked. What do you think he was making atonement for there?
Our arrogance.
Shame.
Yeah.
Our pride,
our arrogance. That's his rank before God. I mean, he really, really drank the last dregs of this humiliation and his pain. That's why there's no such thing as a free lunch. If we really begin to really study the Psalms and study all these prophecies about Jesus Christ and read about the fulfillment in the New Testament, we can see, man, our salvation has cost God an enormous amount in terms of costing him his son. You know what I'm saying? And therefore, we're not going to be able to escape if we neglect this, what he's done for us. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Yeah.